From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. From the huge mainframe computer and the PC to laptops, supercomputers, and even our smartphones, it goes without saying that computers play a significant role in our lives and help us function in today's technologically advanced world. They teach, entertain, and provide access to the world's news and information in mere seconds and help us communicate with each other more effectively. Scientists use computers to study diseases, help develop life-saving medicines, and explore the mysteries of life and even the universe itself. These amazing machines keep the world's businesses, financial markets, and crucial infrastructure, such as transportation and power grids, functioning. But did you know that today's most advanced computers, with all of their sophisticated functions, can trace their roots back to ancient times? On today's Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we'll delve into the history of computers and learn about the inventions and people that led to their development throughout the years. My guest for today's program is Rachel Ignatovsky, author, illustrator, and designer. Among the books she has written is Women in Science, 50 Fearless Pioneers Who Changed the World, which focuses on the contributions of many valuable but overlooked trailblazers in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Her latest book is called The History of the Computer, People, Inventions, and Technology That Changed Our World. Rachel, when some of us remember the first computers, we think of these room-sized pieces of electronics with names like ENIAC and UNIVAC. But in your book, you trace the lineage back to thousands of years ago.
Well, like you said, the first computers were created during World War II in the 1940s. You know, you think of the ENIAC, you think of the UK's Colossus, but the need to have tools that augment our mind, that help our mind think, goes all the way back to ancient civilization. The moment that society got too complicated for ancient humans to just count on their fingers and their toes, they needed tools for storage. And when you think about that, let's talk about the first math artifact, which is a bone found thousands and thousands of years ago that just simply has notches on it to keep track of a tally of how many like sheep were in a flock or how many people were being born. And as society grew, there was the need for doing simple math that was too hard to just store in your head and remember. And that's the invention of the abacus came about. And the abacus actually just started out as a sort of lines drawn in the sand with sticks and using pebbles to kind of have your counters to like remember your placement. And that created this huge sort of technological leap for humanity to start thinking about math in a new way and to be able to build bigger than ever before. And that is kind of the legacy that we're talking about that goes that far back. And that's the technological journey that we go on in this book. What tools are we using to help us think more and build better? You know, the computer at its core is just a tool to help our mind work better almost. And I think Steve Jobs really said it best when he talked about the computer being like a bicycle for the mind.
We're talking about some of the ancient computer-oriented materials and devices. And you mentioned an ancient bone that was used to sort of count sheep. Is that the La Bamba stick?
Yes, that is.
Okay. What about the Antikythera mechanism? And notice that that seems to be one of the first mechanical devices to be used as a computer.
Well, it's really interesting. So it was called a computer, but it wasn't actually a computer. It was a really complicated celestial clock. And it was actually found by some sponge divers around the 1900s. And they find this like slimy piece of corroded metal, and they don't really know what it is. They kind of think it's junk. And it really isn't until the 1970s where they could use X-ray imaging. And then even further in the 1990s, when they started using MRI machines on it, that they could really figure out what this was. And it ends up that it was a wooden box filled filled with incredibly complicated amount of gears that could tell the ancient Romans when, like, the celestial events that were important to them were going to happen. So we're talking about planning the Olympics, planning when crops were going to be grown. And historians think that this was used at every level of bureaucracy, including, like, for the military in ancient Rome.
You had mentioned the abacus and the roots for the abacus, and you mentioned mathematics. So it seems as though these early computing devices sort of evolved about the same time that ancient numerical systems, ancient mathematics were developed.
Yeah, I feel like throughout history, there was different tools that were created, and it's interesting to see how the abacus had developed in so many different places, in so many different ways. So, like, you'll see in Rome, the hand abacus, and then you'll also see later in, like, 1200 CE, the Chopin being developed in China, which is actually still used today. And some people say that using the Chopin, you know, someone skilled on that could actually do it just as some math equations as quick as doing it with a digital calculator, which is, I think, really impressive.
And the word computer itself, when we think of computer, we're thinking of a fairly modern concept and a fairly modern word, but itself could be traced back hundreds of years. When was the word computer first used, and what did it mean then?
Well, the first time the word computer was used was actually in 1613. And it wasn't to describe a machine. It was actually to describe a job. It was to refer to someone who did mathematics. And then later in the 1700s, in the creation of trying to, like, just solve bigger problems, there was this need to kind of break down complicated math equations into smaller sets. And you could see that actually in 1758, when human computers, and that's what they were called, people who did math, worked together to predict Halley's Comet. And this was this, like, a huge success. All of a sudden, governments wanted to fund these kinds of projects where they would put rooms and rooms and rooms of mathematicians together in a room to help create mathematical tables to help with everything from navigating star charts to ballistics. And this was the first sort of, I would say, really large government-funded research to create math resources for the general public.
And of course, Rachel, what comes to mind, in, at least in my mind, is the motion picture Hidden Figures, the story about African-American women who basically were human computers at NASA during the early stages of the space program.
Oh, yeah. Well, Katherine Johnson had the title of human computer. So it's really interesting that even though at that time mechanical computers existed, UNIVAC was already being used by the United States Census Bureau, they weren't really accessible to everyone. And it was really even hard for large organizations like NASA to have more than maybe one or two on each of their campuses. They still relied on humans, like an assembly line, breaking down complicated math equations to do smaller sets of it, and then handing those off to what would be the supervisor and the mathematician in charge of the project. And what's really interesting about Katherine Johnson's story is that she was a genius. And for her, that was a very limiting role for her. So she really broke out of that role by asking questions, going into meetings that she at first wasn't invited to, and showing off her skills. And then she actually became lead in calculating the trajectory for the Apollo mission, which was the first astronauts on the moon. At the same time, the first astronauts on the moon got to use one of the first computers to use a computer chip, the Apollo guidance computer, because you wouldn't be able to get to the moon by navigating it and piloting it by hand. You needed the help of a computer to make that possible as well. So human computers and mechanical computers working together to get the first astronauts to the moon. It's really interesting how the legacy of that goes all the way back to the Industrial Revolution.
I'd like to talk about the Apollo computer in a little bit, because that device alone is interesting as anything. But anyway, let's get back to the human computers and the movie Hidden Figures again. And we're talking about Katherine Johnson. And one scene that comes to mind is John Glenn, as he's preparing for the first American space flight. He was going to orbit the Earth, and they were showing the installation installation of all these mainframe computers being built, all these technical advances. And John Glenn didn't quite trust those computers. And he said, I'm not moving until Katherine Johnson actually computes the trajectory and computes my space flight.
I mean, that's pretty much how it went. That was kind of, you know, a dramatization of the real history. In fact, Katherine Johnson was used at NASA to check all of the computers that they were installing. Yeah. Because if they knew if the numbers matched Katherine's numbers, then those computers were solid and golden. Because there was a lot of mistrust around these new devices. You know, people didn't fully understand them. They were new, big, sort of daunting rooms of blinking lights and whizzing tape. So having that human check on them was really important, just like for people to gain confidence in these new machines.
Getting back to the development of the computer as we know it today, tell us a bit, if you could, about the Jacquard loom and the role it played in the development of the modern computer. I understand it played a big role.
Oh, it definitely did. And during the Industrial Revolution, there were a lot of new machines being made that automated traditionally manual labor, and weaving was one of them. And what was really cool about the Jacquard loom is that it was one of the first programmable machines using punch cards. So what you would do is that your design would basically be punched into the cards, and the Jacquard loom would use those holes to know when the rod should be lowered or lifted to weave, instead of people having to do that by hand. So you could literally load the machine up with a giant row of punch cards and just let it run. And this was huge in, you know, being able to create fabric much quicker. But what's interesting about it is that it also inspired polymaths and what we would come to call computer scientists and engineers like Charles Babbage, who saw these punch cards and realized that he could potentially program a machine that could calculate anything he wanted to program with it. And the design for that machine was called the analytical engine. He was already working on the difference engine, but the analytical engine was what was inspired by the Jacquard loom. And also, even though it was never built, had many of the components in the design of a modern computer. And that machine also inspired Ada Lovelace to come up with programs for the analytical engine in theory, which we now call some of the first computer programs ever created.
Tell us a little more about Charles Babbage and Ada Lovelace and the work that they did and how important their work was to the development of the computer.
So as I was talking before about human computers and how they were dividing mental labor to create these mathematical tables, Charles Babbage was one of the, you know, he was working on one of those programs, and he really didn't like doing it. He found it really boring and frustrating, and while he was working on it, he actually yelled at it. There's writings showing him yelling at one point that he wished, like, by God, I wish these calculations were done by steam. And so there was also this anxiety happening within the government. Whether or not it was true or not doesn't mean it wasn't still something making the government anxious, that the mathematical tables could have errors, and those errors could lead to really serious problems when you're depending on these charts during like a live military fight. So he, seeing this insight and feeling his own frustration, he goes to the British government and he asks them to fund his design for a difference engine that would be able to calculate differential equations and create mathematical tables and print them all with the certainty of a grandfather clock. So in his designs, he would use hundreds and hundreds of bronze gears to calculate, crunch the numbers, and print the tables. So they give him, I would say, the same amount of money that would cost for two new steam locomotives, which a huge sum at the time. They give this to him and they go, go wild, Charles Babbage. And he does. He creates a small section of the difference engine to show proof of concept, which he then shows off at these lavish dinner parties that he enjoyed throwing. But sadly, the difference engine and then the analytical engine were both too complicated to be machined during that time. He also would get into these fights with his machinists over the work. But what's interesting is that one of the people who attended his dinner parties was Ada Lovelace. And Ada Lovelace was a young mathematician and poet herself, and she became enthralled with the difference engine. Later, she would go on to translate a French article about the analytical engine that he designed on paper. And in that translation, she would basically write her own article in the notes, talking about the potential that this machine had, kind of her own theories about how to program the machine. And she had this great insight. While many kind of viewed the analytical engine and the difference engine as just a cold number crunching device, she saw the potential for creativity and said that one day these machines would make music. And even though these machines were never built, the legacy lives on for the next generation of computer scientists. And Howard Aiken, who would go on to be the head of creating and the designer for the Harvard Mark I, which is considered one of the very, very first real computers, he found Charles Babbage's notes during his research, and he said he felt like a ghost was talking to him from the past. So there is this also, when you're learning about computer history, there's this legacy of people standing on each other's shoulders and continuing each other's work. It really is a conversation throughout time.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download at our new website, voaafrica.com. You can also find our show on Apple Podcasts and other websites. Be sure to listen to our other VOA Current Affairs programs, Encounter and Issues in the News. On Encounter, Carol Castiel and her expert guests talk about the substance and impact of the televised congressional committee hearings about the January 6th attack on the Capitol. And on Issues in the News, Kim Lewis and her panel of journalists discuss the top news stories of the week. We hope you'll connect with us on Facebook at VOA Current Affairs or Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. Our email, pcusa@voanews.com. Now, back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Today, we're reviewing the history of computers with author, illustrator, and designer Rachel Ignatovsky. Rachel, can you please tell us about the first electronic computers, how they were constructed, what was unique about them, and how they were operated?
The lineage of the first computers is really interesting because there really isn't one first computer. A lot of engineers and mathematicians had the same idea around the same time. And a lot of people are familiar with The Imitation Game, which is a movie about Alan Turing. And in that movie, we really look at Bletchley Park, which was this ultra-secret campus happening during World War II that was to, with its goal, was to decipher the Nazi code that was being set by the Enigma machines that they were using. And as we all know, information is the lifeblood of any army. So you have to imagine, bombs are raining down in the cities in London, all across England, and at the same time, they're in a race to kind of figure out what Nazi Germany is going to do next. Alan Turing and Tommy Flowers at Bletchley Park devise new ways to keep up with the Enigma machine. And the Enigma machine was like a typewriter with multiple gears that create these complicated codes with over like thousands and thousands of combinations. And they would reset every 24 hours with a new cipher key. So to keep up with this, Alan Turing creates the bombs, which are basically like a reverse Enigma machine. So these aren't computers, but they do the trick. The problem is that there are even more complicated ciphers and encryptors that the Nazis are using. And that includes the Lorenz code, which was for Nazi high command. For this, Tommy Flowers realizes that they have to figure out how to build a computer. And they do this with intense pressure and intense time restraints, and it's called the Colossus. And the Colossus uses vacuum tubes and large papers of whizzing tape. And even though these computers are dumb by today's standards. It was what they needed to be able to keep up with the amount of calculations that they had to do. Meanwhile, in the United States, around the same time, Howard Aiken and programmer Grace Hopper are working on the Harvard Mark I, which I've mentioned before. And this didn't use vacuum tubes. Instead, it used these mechanical relay switches. And it was a loud and noisy machine. And it was to help them to calculate missile trajectories and complicated differential equations and eventually to work on the Manhattan Project, which was a national priority at the time. And again, these computers were massive. They filled entire rooms. They were incredibly hot. And they were noisy, slow, and constantly broke. So although they were quicker by doing the calculations by hands and with the tools that were available, they were no means anything like the computers that we use today.
When we were thinking of computers, at least back in the 60s and 70s, normally thought of the big mainframe computers. Tell us about the development and evolution of the personal computer and the impact you think it made on society.
Well, the personal computers have a really different lineage than these big mainframe computers that were being built by, you know, IBM and other private businesses and also being used by like the Census Bureau. This was a sort of ragtag team of eccentrics, of hippies, of academics who were kind of upset that they couldn't have their own personal computers and that big companies like IBM and Honeywell weren't interested in building them at all. IBM basically had a monopoly on the computer market at the time in the 1960s. They didn't think that people would even want to have computers in their home. Back then, you have to think computers were huge, they were expensive, and even mini computers were cost prohibitive. And mini computers, when I say mini, I mean a computer that was the size of a refrigerator. Those really were only being able to be afforded by universities and maybe like super fancy private schools to have one that people would then access with a terminal. So in the 1970s, there was a bunch of young people who grew up seeing these large computers, having access to the mini computers, who dreamed of being able to have the power of computing in their own home where they could program a computer to do whatever silly or serious task that they might want. So there was this group in the Bay Area called the Homebrew Computer Club, and it was a rowdy bunch. But they would come together, they would share ideas, they would share inventions that they kind of tinkered with in their own garage, and eventually together they worked towards something that would look like a small personal computer. And again, when we say personal computer, we're talking about a motherboard in a box that you would have to put together yourself, solder yourself, and then also program yourself. It was still like a lot of technical knowledge to be able to do that. And there was just a couple people with deep insight who thought, what could I do if I redesigned this in a way where you could use this right out of the box? And the one person who really accomplished that was Steve Wozniak with his creation of the Apple I. And he did it just for fun, just because he wanted it for himself. And through his tinkering, he transformed the entire computer industry.
Well, we're speaking of personal computing, and it's become pretty much a daily tool that we all use. What are some of the key developments you see from the development of the personal computer itself to today? What are some of the key moments?
Well, I think the development of the graphic user interface is one of the most important moments there is in getting computers in the hands of individuals and kind of getting us to where we are today. Like I said before, even with the invention of the personal computer in the 1970s, there was still a learning curve. You still had to know code. You had to have some technical knowledge to be able to turn it on and make it do what you wanted to do. It really wasn't until the 1980s when the collaboration between Xerox PARC and Apple created what we call the desktop metaphor. So Xerox PARC, they developed the desktop metaphor. And what the desktop metaphor is it's icons on the computer that represent their real life counterpart. So like a clock looks like a clock, your email looks like a little envelope, and you can click on those icons to then use your computer. So it's just completely intuitive as soon as you turn it on. And Apple really helped commercialize it by putting it on their Apple Lisa and on their first 1984 Macintosh, which is an iconic classic computer. I remember when I was just 7 years old and I went to the library myself for this technology night that they were having. My mom took me and I'm just a little kid. And there it was. It was the Mac Classic Color. And at 7 years old, I start clicking around. I open the paint program up and I start drawing a giraffe. Immediately knew how to use the computer as a child. And that is a really radical idea when you're thinking about the legacy of computers, because for the majority of computer history, it could only be used by people who were specially trained. And honestly, for the majority of computer history, it was a giant mainframe kept away in an isolated room that you weren't even allowed to play with. You know, it was men in white lab coats who ran the computers. And just a couple decades later, I'm a little 7-year-old at the library painting a giraffe. I think that's really radical. And it's all thanks to the GUI, the graphic user interface.
I think the biggest step so far, if we're looking at modern history, has to be the smartphone.
Oh, yes. The all-in-one device. 2007 is when the first smartphone came out. And, you know, a lot of people before that in the 90s were trying to kind of smash technology together. And that's the interesting thing about computers is that computers are always trying to converge, to mash technology together. Everything eventually becomes a computer, as we can see right now with this Internet of Things that we're living in. But the smartphone, it combined a computer with a telephone, with a video camera, with a media machine. And 2007, when Steve Jobs demos it and plays Green Day as a throwback on it and shows that every time you open a new application, the graphic user interface on the screen completely changes it. You use gestural commands to control it. It opened up an entire world of computing. And now more people have smartphones than they have desktop computers. And there's nearly a phone in every pocket in the developing world.
For a final question, we can go back to the Apollo computer. From what I understand, the smartphone has like tens of times the computing power that the Apollo computer had.
Oh, yeah. Hundreds of thousands of times more computing power. The Apollo computer has the same amount of power to it as a Nintendo NES, if anyone remembers playing that when they're a kid. The Apollo guidance computer was incredibly limited. In fact, while it was in space, it actually overloaded at one point because it was running like two programs at once. And so while they're trying to land the Apollo lunar lander, red and yellow lights start going off. But luckily, Margaret Hamilton, who was the lead in programming the Apollo guidance computer and basically created the field of computer engineering, she saw that coming and she made sure that if you just pressed go, that it would order the sequence by priority instead of sequence. So they landed safely, because that wouldn't have been the same story if they didn't program the Apollo guidance computer correctly, because it did have very limited functionality. But at the same time, it was literally the most advanced piece of equipment that there was. Integrated circuits were just invented years earlier, and it was one of the first uses of integrated circuits. So it was the smallest computer that ever existed to that point. And yeah, even though by today's standards, all we can really do with it is play a video game on it, then it was the most advanced piece of equipment there was. And now we carry around in our pocket a device that is 100,000 times more powerful than that, that basically has access to the whole sum of human knowledge with just a flick of the finger.
Rachel Ignatovsky, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today about your new book and for bringing us through the years of the history of the computer.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. Again, this book is filled with illustrations. It's filled with fun facts. And I wrote it because I wanted to give people a better understanding of the world we live in today. And you can only do that by learning history.
That was best-selling author, illustrator, and designer Rachel Ignatovsky. Her latest book is called The History of the Computer, People, Inventions, and Technology That Changed Our World. The book is published by 10 Speed Press and is available through your favorite bookseller. And that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. I'd like to thank you for listening to our program today. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.